Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com. /awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome to the club that you didn't want to join. We're the voice of rare disease, and this jingle doesn't rhyme. NordPod, NordPod, NordPod.
My name is Matthew Zachary, and welcome to NordPod, right here on the Off-Script Media Network. Now, I've been advocating on behalf of cancer and rare disease patients for over 20 years. Why? Because I am one. NordPod is the official podcast of the National Organization for Rare Disorders. And a quick reminder before we get started that if you like the show, please leave us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts because it helps other listeners like you discover the show. Now, let's get started. Hello, friends and all new subscribers. Welcome back to NordPod, the voice of rare disease. On the show today, Jeff Goldstein, president and founder of the Lung Transplant Foundation, a nonprofit organization that provides education and emotional support for transplant recipients and their caregivers, as well as raising tons of money for lung transplant research. Jeff was diagnosed in his mid-40s in peak health with idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. Lots of syllables, very bleak outcome. And yet, 18 years later, he's still here to talk about not just his incredible story, but the extraordinary partnership he struck with NORD's Rare Launch Research Ready program to kick off their first patient registry for this truly undervoiced community. This is a great show. You're going to love it. Let's get started. Jeff Goldstein, thanks for coming on NordPod.
Thank you, Matthew, for inviting me. My pleasure.
I always like to start out with the personal story, sort of the 101 of what got you here. And I can't help but notice that you had a double lung transplant 18 years ago, Mazel Tov, on 18. But let's unpack that. That's not something you kind of just say lightly.
That's true, and it didn't happen lightly. I was taking out the trash one day, and I fell to the curb. I couldn't catch my breath. And that following Wednesday, I was diagnosed with an end-stage lung disease called idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, a fibrotic lung disease that presages a lung transplant if you want to survive. And so I made arrangements to receive a double lung transplant. I was transplanted at Duke University Hospitals on July 6th of 2003. Every day I wake up, first I'm grateful, and then I'm fearful. Fearful of the process that takes most lung transplant recipients within the first 5 years, and another significant percentage at 10 years. It's estimated that there's only 20% of us left alive after 10 years due to complications from transplant called rejection, primarily bronchiolitis obliterans. This form of rejection destroys the small airways, the bronchioles. So like the pre-transplant lung diseases, all the fibrotic lung diseases, idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, cystic fibrosis, et cetera, this fibrotic component destroys the alveoli, where the exchange of oxygen and carbon dioxide takes place. So it's kind of a slow suffocation. And if I can paint a picture for you, imagine trying to breathe through a straw that continually gets, whose diameter is continually reduced.
You know, I worked in cancer advocacy for 15 years, and we had this running joke because, you know, only cancer people can tell cancer jokes, which is that the more syllables, the worse off. And just idiopathic itself is way too many syllables to even start whatever came after that. So I can only imagine the absolute and utter trepidations. And this is 18 years ago. I want to talk later in the show about how far we've come in the practice of going through this. I was diagnosed in 96, so it was like medieval times with brain cancer. But to the extent that this was delivered to you 18 years ago, what was the treatment back then?
There were no treatments back then. It is an end-stage lung disease. There are a couple of therapies that have been developed specifically for pulmonary fibrosis, this fibrotic lung disease, but it only works on a small amount of the patient population. And if you're lucky, it just slows the progression. So ultimately, if you want to survive any of the end-stage lung diseases, you'll need a lung transplant. And if you're fortunate enough to be accepted at a program and then fortunate enough to get the gift of life, another pair of lungs, then you're going to want to protect those very, very carefully. And just to back up a bit, you're right. Idiopathic is a lot of symbols, and it's just a medical term for we don't know what causes it.
So are lung transplants the same in terms of donations, in terms of like kidney and heart? Are you on a registry, a waiting list?
Yes, great question. It is the same process in terms of evaluation at the transplant center, and that includes your current health status, how sick you are. And in the lung transplant process, you are given what's called a lung allocation score at that center. Your name and all that information is entered into a massive computer system at UNOS, which stands for United Network of Organ Sharing. And that's the government public entity that manages the distribution of organs for transplant. Organs are, when they're made available, they are retrieved by localized organization called an OPO, for an organ procurement organization. These organizations reside in various areas of the country. I think there's 13 or 15 of them, I can't remember, but they're responsible for retrieving the organs from kidneys to livers to hearts to lungs, etc., within that region, and then they're matched via the UNOS computer system to the individual who needs them most, and of course meets certain criteria, blood match, histamine match, etc. And the best match is offered to that individual at the transplant center, and if you're fortunate enough to get that, you could proceed with a lung transplant.
That's extraordinary. How old is the lung transplant procedure? When was the first one done?
Memory serves me correctly. It's like, I think, 83 or 84. It was not very successful. And I think it took 2 or 3 years, again, if memory serves me correctly, for the process to start to really gain traction. And that was because the anti-rejection medicines weren't fully developed. And those anti-rejection medicines, which prevent any individual who's received a organ transplant, a solid organ transplant, from rejecting them, those medicines were designed and developed for kidney transplant recipients. And that remains true today for lung transplant patients. None of the medications that we take to survive and deal with the myriad of complications that we're subjected to over the life of our post-transplant process, none of them were developed for lung transplant. They're all off-label, and sometimes a doctor will tell you, we'll try it and hope it works.
So like I said, we're going to fast forward to today in the second part of the show, but I really do want to dive into the extent that you're willing to share the impact that this had on you, your family, children, relatives, friends.
Yeah, Matthew, that's a really hard, it's a hard thing for all of us to relive, quite frankly. I was in my early 40s, mid 40s. I had a business that was doing very well and a lovely wife, and it changed overnight. With that diagnosis, everything changed. You know, within a short period of time, I lost my business. I wasn't able to act as the president and CEO and chief bottle washer. And so, and I had to make arrangements to survive. And that meant going to Duke, upending my life and my wife's life to spend the time there to complete the transplant process. So most centers require that you be within a certain radius of the center, and it's generally 2 to 4 hours, so that when you're notified, you can get to the center in time, so that any of the organs that are delivered, in my case, lungs, right, would still be viable. And so for us, that required us moving to the North Carolina area to accommodate that and participate in a pre-transplant conditioning program while waiting, right, for the call. And I got to tell you, it's pretty difficult to upend your life to do something like that. We left the house here. My wife actually had to apply for a transfer, and we had to commit to being in the Raleigh-Durham area for 3 years as part of that. And so it really, really changed our life. And while traumatic as it was for my wife and I, it was really the only option. We knew what we had to do to survive. And I, at one point, I told my doctor, sorry, you get me the lungs and I'll do the rest.
Ah, I love that.
And I got to tell you, it's the hardest thing I have ever done and could ever have imagined. I was the model pre-transplant recipient, running around the track and doing all the exercises and record time and being done when everybody else was still working on it. And after my transplant, oh, it was a struggle. It was a struggle.
Is this condition typically in the older populations? Were you the odd man out in your 40s, perfectly healthy, to get this?
No. So IPF, I was pretty much within the model. It typically affects males in the mid-40s. The disease, depending upon when you're diagnosed, can take years to fully develop and affect you, and then you kind of drop off the end of a chart. It's interesting, I read an article while researching it. If you could take all the tissue in your lungs and spread them out on a flat surface, it would cover the square area of a tennis court.
Wow.
So you can imagine that, you know, how much damage you'd have to have in the lungs for you to start to feel it, and then reach that point where you have no other option but to get a lung transplant because you're, you know, slowly suffocating to death.
Do you feel that when you're brought into, like, let's just call it like the the idiopathic store that you never wanted to shop in, you really have no mentor or greeter to tell you what to do, when you're partially reliant on your own maybe embedded chutzpah to stand up for yourself and know what you want, take charge? Clearly you had to upend everything you chose to move. You managed that. Most people don't have that. Or is it fair to think that most people just may not have that embedded chutzpah, and perhaps your observations on that for yourself and other people?
Great question, Matt. Great question. So yes, I'm very, very fortunate to have the chutzpah and that real desire to survive. And over the years that I've been involved in the lung transplant world, that's not true of everybody. You know, that's a choice an individual has to make. But I can tell you that it's challenging. And you're right, there's, at least back then, there were few places that an individual who was diagnosed with idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, or for that matter, any other lung, end-stage lung disease, could go to. They would go to the organizations like that were related to their diagnosis. So if you if I Googled idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, I would find a lot of information about idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, or IPF, but very little about transplant. And that was true for a lot of the end-stage lung disease organizations. Very little information was given about lung transplant, and primarily because it was a lot more challenging process back then, a lot less successful, and a lot of organizations didn't feel comfortable in recommending it to their population because they were concerned about, you know, the outcomes. So that's been a challenge. A lot better now, and I like to think that's because of my chutzpah and the organization I formed called the Lung Transplant Foundation that advocates and agitates on behalf of lung transplant patients.
Back with our guest after the break.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply. CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure, with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
It's been said that we're all kind of born of our condition, and we often make the choices we never expected to have. You know, man plants, God laughs, that cat poster kind of thing. I never knew I would start a nonprofit organization. I just knew at some point after I was through all of my nonsense that it made sense because I felt like I could do something that needed to exist that no one else had done. And again, so you started a nonprofit organization. Let's talk about your decision to do that. The struggles, perhaps, to get it off the ground. We can share all the war stories we want in terms of being nonprofit founders. But the Lung Transplant Foundation, was it the first of its kind?
Yes, sir. It came about because I started losing friends that I had been in the pre-transplant program at Duke with to this rejection issue, BOSS. And I was a businessman for the longest time. And prior to my transplant, and I couldn't understand why we would spend as a public, private insurance, healthcare, et cetera, why we would spend upwards of $1 million to perform a lung transplant and treat and manage the individual post-transplant and not have anything developed for these rejection issues. I couldn't understand it. And as I got involved with a not-for-profit here in South Florida, connected to organ donation, and I learned a little bit about it and decided that I needed to do something to further this cause. And that was pretty naive. I thought, hey, I'd start this foundation, I'll raise a couple $1 million real quick, and we'll fund some research and find a cure.
Famous last words.
Yes, exactly. Here we are some 13 years later, and we're just now pushing the envelope.
Yeah, I used to be told, so how was Stupid Cancer, that was the name of the organization I started, how was this so successful? And I was like, well, it's an overnight success that took 14 years.
You're exactly right. It's an overnight success that took us 14 years, a lot of hard work, a lot of time and effort, a lot of money, fundraising, some wonderful supporters. And quite frankly, I think most of it is due to the success of our community, our lung transplant recipients who are connected to the organization, who support us and help us through the hard times, if you will. So we've remained true to those connections. And I think, you know, what we've been very successful at to date is disseminating information to the lung transplant community about what's available to them in terms of treatments and therapies. We've developed a very robust program for mentoring both patients and their caregivers. I can imagine what you went through as well. You have a caregiver. I think sometimes that's harder. You have a loved one who's going through something like what you experienced or what I've experienced or any end-stage lung disease patient's experienced. That caregiver feels it as well, and I think experiences that frustration of not being able to do anything. So we offer this mentorship program. We connect them to people who have been through the experience as well and help them get through it. That's a very, very successful program for us. We're doing it now for 3 years. We're very, very proud of it. It's called the Joseph J. Carter Mentorship Program, named after an individual who donated some money to start it with us, whose husband was unable to find anybody to help him because he was diagnosed with a very rare end-stage lung disease.
And it can't be understated, the value of adding the caregiver conversation to your mission. And again, we started this in the 2000s when, you know, we were just so worried about dying immediately that anyone else, nothing really mattered. We just wanted to get enough done. And then everyone else was kind of second because it mattered if you lived. Let's level set the conversation. So kudos on bringing that narrative into your mission. It's so important and so critical. I did want to jump into, again, channeling our nonprofit founder war stories. You wanted to launch a patient registry, and you are partnering with NORD, an organization that I was a member of in 1996, because pediatric brain cancer is a rare cancer, and you belong to NORD on day one. So talk about how you managed to integrate with NORD and what possessed you to start a registry.
Another great question, Matt. So bronchiolitis obliterans, or BOS, which is this disease that takes the lives of almost 50-55% of lung transplant recipients after 10 years, is a rare disease as described by the Federal Drug Administration, the FDA. And we became aware of NORD probably 3 or 4 years ago through an individual that I met who was previously involved in the American Thoracic Society's public advisory roundtable. And she connected us, and we immediately got involved with the organization because we understood the value of connecting to people and organizations that, you know, were experiencing the same processes and frustrations that we were. And through my ATS public advisory roundtable, or PAR connections, we came to know a company that's got some incredible technology for diagnosing changes in lung function. And over the last 2 or 3 years, as they've been developing that, we've been watching it very carefully. And we came to believe that this could be a very valuable tool in not just managing lung transplant rejection issues, but managing changes in all end-stage lung diseases. So an individual is diagnosed with, say, with cystic fibrosis at an early age. They need to be monitored for a lot of years before they might need a transplant. And exposure to CAT scan and radiation can be a problem. So this process that 4D Medical has developed is going to be what we think is really, really instrumental in managing patients with lung diseases pre and post transplant, or pre and post end stage, if you will. And they came to us and said, you know, what can we do? And we said, well, we want to jump on this opportunity, bring it to lung transplant centers and make them aware of this so they can see what this is about. And how does the Lung Transplant Foundation use that opportunity to connect to the patients, right? And we talked to several organizations about how to do this, and some were so complicated that even our techies didn't understand it. And others, we just couldn't find the right fit. And we became aware of the NORD registry program and jumped on it. We contacted them immediately. We actually attended a couple of webinars, find out more about it. We reached out and connected to Suzanne and Danielle at NORD, and they were extremely helpful in connecting us to the program. And it's a perfect match. It's a perfect match to help us develop our registry, connect to patients, make our patients feel comfortable about collecting the data that we're going to ask for and how we'll use it. All very important aspects of managing a registry in terms of how the patient perceives it.
I like to think at certain points in your life, you've learned enough, you're done with your skills, you're baked, and then all of a sudden, there's a registry. Can you talk about like the top two or three aha moments you've had understanding the value and the impact this actually has to patients?
Yeah, so I would say the first aha moment was when I saw the technology on a screen, a 4D vision of the lungs showing ventilatory changes as a result of an end-stage lung disease, and just thought it was incredible. The second aha moment was I realized that a wider adoption of this technology would help us manage patients better. We always say that early diagnosis leads to early treatment, leads to better outcomes. And this was right up the alley. And then the third aha moment was when I was on that webinar about the NORD registry, and I can't remember who was running it, but at the end of it, I said, this is exactly what our community needs. This is exactly how we can manage it. It's exactly how I can answer all the questions and concerns that our committee and board members had about establishing a registry. And it's also probably the best way that we can make the transplant centers that we're going to engage in this program and registry, we can make them feel comfortable about working with the Lung Transplant Foundation as part of this process.
So just for the listeners, that the Rare Launch Research Ready program is a thing that NORD hosts every year. And yeah, this is kind of an advertisement for it because it really makes a lot of sense to all of the nonprofit founders and the nonprofit researchers and the advocates that are looking into, you know, it's kind of like, is this right for you? It probably is. Sell us on how important this has been to the nonprofit you started, the Lung Transplant Foundation.
Well, I would say, first of all, any organization, not for profit, that's considering a registry for whatever that registry might be, I would certainly suggest you get connected to NORD and involved here and learn more about the programs. It's extremely flexible and manageable, which is a pretty significant part, as I've learned, a pretty significant part of developing a registry. So that's one. And I can't really overestimate the value of having a registry that's being managed by an organization such as NORD. Their reputation for what they do, how they do it, and how they represent patient communities of you know, experiencing rare diseases is extraordinary. And so connecting with an organization such as NORD, really, quite frankly, between you and me, I think gives us a lot of credibility and actually will challenge us to up our game and make this as valuable to our community as we think it will be.
So no one ever wakes up one day and says, I can't wait to be on the public advisory roundtable of the American Thoracic Society. And yet, here you are all these years later. I want to sort of wrap up the interview by you talking about what it means to be a patient advocate and building something that you wished that you had 18 years ago.
Wow. That's a That's an extraordinary question. So
you have 30 seconds. I'm totally kidding.
So I was asked to speak at an ATS conference because a board member of mine, a founding board member of mine, was too sick to do so. And I took her place. She subsequently passed away and was asked to participate in the PAR for the ATS. That connection has been extraordinarily just incredible for the development of the Lung Transplant Foundation and our connection. So, you know, I could have never imagined asking for that, wasn't even aware of that. And it was a fortuitous invite, quite frankly. And certainly we've jumped on the opportunity to leverage that opportunity and build connections all throughout the medical community and organizations, national organizations, government organizations to advocate and agitate on behalf of our patient population.
You had me at advocate and agitate. I think that's going to be our band name if we start one, which we should. Jeff Goldstein, president and founder of the Lung Transplant Foundation, Mensch advocate. Amazing story. Thank you for making the huge dents in the universe that needed to be made on behalf of your community and joining us here on NordPod.
Thank you, Matt.
That's all for today. If you like the show, be sure to subscribe, leave a review, follow us on social, and tell all your friends to listen. NordPod is a product of the National Organization for Rare Disorders and Offscript Media. Our executive producers are Matthew Zachary and Leslie Nordstrom. Andrew McDowell is our senior producer. Valerie Don Francesco is our marketing manager. Darren Tun is our production intern. It is recorded, mixed, and edited by Matthew Zachary and the post-production team at Offscript Media. Our theme music is by The Salvatones. Learn more about the music of The Salvatones at salvatones.org. For advertising and media inquiries, email media@offscript.com. Hit us up at contact@offscript.com to share comments, feedback, and make guest recommendations. For more information, visit nordpod.org.